Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Does anyone ever say, you know what, you've done a fucking good job with politics out the boy bits because everyone else has just sat on their arse and done nothing? Any sign of that? No.
This is the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt, surely bringing the best of my Times radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times radio app. Coming up on today's episode, we're going back to the future, Blair to the future, if you like, taking a look at Keir Starmer's very retro reshuffle. Patrick Maguire takes us through what it all actually means. Ignore everyone else. Patrick Maguire knows what he's talking about. Chris Ward used to work for Keir Starmer and has helped him on previous reshuffles. Plus, Peter Mandelson, yes, Lord Mandelson, no less, joins us to discuss whether or not this really is a return to the new Labour days. All that's coming up in just a moment. But first, as we always do, let's take a look at the news for today's columnist panel.
The Columnists on Times Radio.
Joined this morning, as we always are on a Tuesday morning, by Danny Finkelstein. Hello, Danny Finkelstein.
Hello. The Mandarin restaurant that was just up the road from my parents' house.
That's what you'd bring back from the
90s. Yeah, yeah.
Very good. And
don't ask me. I thought we'd got away with that. Oh, I don't
John
know.
John Stevens of the Daily Mirror.
Oh, I don't know. Pass.
What were you doing in the 90s? Were you born in the 90s?
Yeah, I was, sadly. I was a child at school, primary school.
Yeah.
Who knows?
What about that left-wing Sunday newspaper? What was that called? I've forgotten now. That was maybe the 1980s. They had the News on Sunday. That's
now you're making
called.
Me look totally ignorant. Just news on showing Sunday. Me up again.
Do you not remember that?
No.
Now there's an amazing book on it about how they created this newspaper that was going to be the newspaper of the left because all the newspapers, you know, the Daily Mail, patch of the Daily Mail, were supposed to be right-wing, so they created this. And it was just a disaster. No one read it, and people would come into reception and demand to be seen by the editor, pressure groups, you know, because their story, and they had fights in which one person, you know, the political editor punched the arts editor and said, that's for the working class. And that's what it was. It's an absolutely fantastic book. It's called something like, the story of the news, disaster, the story of the news on Sunday, I think it's called.
There we are. Launched in April 1987. It closed 7 months later.
Oh, I missed out then. So it
was. Yeah. There we are. When you start talking about a little red Sunday, left-wing Sunday newspaper, I thought you meant The Independent on Sunday when I worked there. Anyway, let's move on and stop reminiscing about the 90s. Right, let's come bang up to date, just because it's still really funny. Let's take a listen to Gillian Keegan getting cross.
Does anyone ever say, you know what, you've done a good job because everyone else has sat on their and done nothing? No signs of that, no?
Now, there's an interesting question here, Danny, because Rishi Sunak keeps sort of making the same point. Why does nobody give us the credit for the things we have done? Most schools aren't falling down. People aren't really struggling.
Look, so I'd say two things. The most important thing to say first is I can't believe they're trying to run this argument. It will never, ever, ever work. Governments are responsible. He's the Prime Minister. She's the Education Secretary. They're simply responsible when something like this happens. And not only, you know, will the country expect it in a common sense way, but also all political science shows people just simply hold the government, you know, to account stroke to blame for it. I understand the point they're trying to make. They're trying to make the point that what they did was actually call time on it. It's something that is in lots of buildings all over the world, and they've actually said, no, we have to do something about this. And what they expect. But completely naively is that everyone will be grateful for that instead of feeling somebody should have done something about it. And, you know, the Conservative Party's been in power for 13 years, so they're reasonable candidates for it. So I think this, you know, while it's possible just about to comprehend where the frustration comes from after you've been asked questions about it all day, it's really, really ill-judged. And it's completely, definitely, 100,000% will not work.
John, have you seen the graphics on Twitter?
I have. I mean, that's what I was going to point to. I mean, in the last hour, Gillian Keegan herself has tweeted a graphic that just in big letters says most schools, and then in big underlined in red, unaffected, most schools unaffected. So the message seems to be, well, there's only some schools where pupils are at risk of dangerous concrete falling on them and killing them. It's such a bad argument. And you can just think, goodness me, this isn't like just some tweet that was put up on some mundane issue that won't get much scrutiny. We've had several days of this now. You think they would be looking over everything and think, do you think that's quite the right messaging? Not at all.
Isn't there an Alan Partridge joke where he goes through all the years where nothing happens and then one year ran over one child?
No, it's from the day to day. But it is Steve Coogan and he's playing the security guard in a swimming pool. And he goes, in 1987, no one died. In 1998, no one died. In 1989, someone died. In 1990, no one died. And he's like, well, look at all these other years where no one died on my watch. So basically, lots of people are now doing spoofs of this Gillian Keegan thing, including the Labour Party, which has put out, Gillian Keegan's was called Jaws Update. It's called Rack Update. The Labour one is called Jaws Update. And it just says, most beachgoers not eaten by big shark.
Well, it's a very fascinating thing about the Jaws. That was a real event. And in the subsequent presidential election, Woodrow Wilson, who had absolutely nothing, obviously, to do with beach policy in New Jersey, he suffered in the areas where there were shark attacks. There was a depression in his vote. In other words, the electorate, not only... is the argument risible, but it can't work. People just hold the government responsible, and it'd be much better for Gillian Keegan and Rishi Sunak to say, I'm going to concentrate on how to put this problem right. We can leave an argument about whose fault it was to later. And, they're going to have that argument and they will not win it. So if you increase the salience of it, you're just increasing the salience of a negative issue for you. I don't actually, as it happens, think that this government does anything more than share the blame that's shared out between the people who built these buildings, local authorities, governments over the years, all the people who've inspected it. Everybody who's been responsible for it has been responsible for overseeing things like this. And I suppose everybody's been involved in their professional life in things they think afterwards, well, we certainly could have done that a lot better. And it's got terrible consequences. What you don't do in those circumstances is then try and, say, well, my blame for it is only a small proportion, other people's blame for it. They're not going to win that battle. It's not an edifying battle to fight. The fact that they feel it, they feel sort of too much of it has been placed on them, even though I actually think, if you sat down with a piece of paper, that is a reasonable argument. Yeah, It'll never, ever fly.
But it's not just on this issue, is it, John? It's like Rishi Sunak a few weeks ago got really like a bit snippy about how much money they'd spent on energy bills. And so you might not have noticed, but actually we did spend lots of money on energy bills. And it's this sort of... He's doing it as well on other issues. This sort of like, actually, I think you'll find... And once you're doing that, that these are conversations to be had behind closed doors.
Yeah, and I think Rishi Sunak can be a bit thin-skinned. Occasionally in interviews, something does get to him like that and he starts going about, oh, I was the Chancellor who did furlough, rah, 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 rah. But with all of these things, we know that a lot of the time that ministers didn't personally cause the problem. But the whole point of being a government minister, or maybe not the whole point, but a key part of the job is things happen in the country and you have to fix them and you need to come up with, as Danny said, the answers. And the thing that government haven't been able to do over the last few days, a story started appearing in the newspapers at the beginning of last week and then it properly kicked off, was it on Thursday evening? And then even on Sunday, which is several days later, when Jeremy Hunt was doing the broadcast round, he wasn't able to say, this is the problem, this is the scale of it, and this is what we're going to do. He just seemed a bit jumbled. Yesterday, after not appearing on TV or radio for several days, apart from doing that odd YouTube clip with dance music in the background, Gillian Keegan was barely off the TV. You know, she did all the morning round, then she had to go back on again, do a pool clip, apologise for swearing. Then she was in the Commons, and then she was out in the evening. But those basic questions of what is the exact scale of this problem and what are you going to do about it, they still don't have an answer on. And why do we still not have this list of schools, which just seems the mad thing? And when you say to the ministers, why have you not published a list of schools which are affected? They keep saying, oh, it would be wrong to publish it in case the parents involved aren't aware and da-da-da-da. And it's like, this isn't a case where the police don't want to name someone's died because they're struggling to get hold of a family member who's on holiday in like Tahiti or something. It's just like, well, surely parents should know by now. And if they don't know by now, that is, there's a problem.
The government could do, could tell them.
So it's one of the things that I often sort of say to politicians, if you can't, if you just, let's start with what the answer to this question is. If you decide you can't share that answer, why don't you share the reasons you can't share it? If you feel that you can't share that, then maybe you're in the wrong position. And so, you know, if the government does have a and often you find, you know, I remember during the 1997 general election, the government couldn't recall Parliament in order to look at a report, right? And it wasn't in its power, and yet it's sort of, it wasn't allowed to say so for all sort of various legal reasons. It got itself into a position where it had a decent answer, but then it wasn't allowed to say what the answer was. These things can happen in government, but you've got to find a way of articulating that. So people need to understand that. If there is a reason why the government decides it can't, and it's one that was compelling enough to persuade them, and again, something I say to politicians, if an argument was compelling enough to persuade you to take this course of action, maybe it'll be compelling enough to persuade other people to agree with you. So why don't you share it? And I find very perplexing often in politics. And they must have been persuaded not to do this. Intelligent people, Rishi Sunak's very intelligent, and so is Gillian Keegan. They must have sat around, had a meeting with a lot of other intelligent people and agreed at the end, no, that policy should be not to share it, right? Because they know they're under this pressure. Well, why?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure there is a reason, because otherwise they wouldn't have taken it. Well, why don't they share that? We can all then judge whether that's a ridiculous reason, but there must be one.
Well, let's move on, because maybe we should reflect on whether or not it would be any different if Liz Truss was still Prime Minister. It's a year ago today she was named the new Tory leader, so the anniversary is tomorrow when she actually entered Downing Street. And John, you've been marking this anniversary with some very important journalism.
Which I'm always well known for important journalism, but yeah, this is... Remember when she's Prime Minister, she had that weird lectern which just looked like a higgledy-piggledy pile of wooden bricks. And it was just distinctive.
The Jenga lectern.
The Jenga lectern, yeah. That was it. They spent £4,000 on it because obviously all Prime Ministers need their own personalised lectern rather than the kind of plain one that came before. And hers was slightly more eye-catching. They spent all this money on the lectern. And then, obviously, she didn't last as Prime Minister for very long. And usually, because not many people remember what the lecterns look like, they end up getting recycled. They pop them in, you know, the Department for Business or the embassy in Paris or Honolulu or wherever. They find a new life. But sadly for this lectern, it is still somewhere in number 10.
Because it's too well known.
We should have an exhibition of, and maybe the British Museum could do that as they've joined in, of fiascos. right? And so maybe political fiascos. You could have William's baseball cap, which obviously and I was in the vicinity of. You could have this... lectern, the Jenga lectern, the Ed Miliband's The Millie Stone. You could have that without question. The advert, the Tory demonised advert.
But do you think there is a problem in this country that where would you go to see political memorabilia? Because it doesn't quite fit in the V&A or the Science Museum or Natural History. And the British Museum, it's a while since I've been around the British Museum, but it doesn't seem to have those sort of like bits and pieces.
Because in America, all former presidents have
Well, that's what I was going to say. Do we need a Liz Truss?
It's now an eBay.
Do we need a Liz Truss Prime Ministerial Library is basically the conclusion we're coming to. That just somewhere, a monument where people can visit.
Because I'd like to see that. Funnily enough, I found I liked the lecture when I first saw it, but I also I've also always had a political analogy of Jenga, which is that in politics you don't know which is the brick that you're going to pull out, that will the whole, and that's obviously a fundamental conservative tenet, that, that sort of society is like Jenga and you never know which brick, so you're always cautious about
pulling
them
out. It was billions of pounds of uncosted tax cuts.
Yeah. Exactly.
So surprise, surprise.
It was an amazing metaphor for a premiership.
It was that. It was a block in Jenga, which everyone said, don't touch that one. It was that one.
Completely. Yeah. So it was a metaphor. But I really, really agree. Maybe this programme can be the genesis of it.
Yeah.
I really agree that a kind of well, you know, when you finally publish your book, your book about these kind of things,
50 places.
Yeah, you do 50 objects.
50 objects.
It
would check fit. I'll make a note of that.
I think it would fit with it. And objects. It's very policy. Descriptive.
They might be quite similar to the 50 places. But yeah, I think a museum of political fiasco. There's definitely something in that. That's tomorrow's show sorted. If you've got any ideas for the Museum of Political Fiasco, email me, matt@times.radio. But we don't know where this lectern is.
John. Somewhere in Downing Street. So using freedom of information laws, usually used to get loads of data and boring things and spreadsheets that you have to kind of put together. I did it last...
Sorry, John, I was going to take a call. The Washington Post or something. They want to hide. They want to make a film.
So I did an FOI earlier this year saying, where is the lectern? And they said, well, usually they get repurposed, but this one's in Downing Street. And then when I saw it was currency anniversary, I put it in my jar. I thought, I'll do that over the summer, put in another FOI. Yeah. See if it has found a home. No,
they won't necessarily know where it is. So when I was working for John Major, we first of all were going to give a presentation in the cabinet room, and all I wanted was one of those, you know, overhead projectors. I mean, older, and they said, sir, this is Downing Street. It's not a conference centre. And then when we subsequently did a presentation at Chequers, this involved the head of the number 10 Downing Street policy unit having to drive into Downing Street, go into the basement to find one of these overhead projectors because it was never used, and drive it personally to Chequers. So this is how, at least I think that the Blair government that got elected in 1997, note the segue, was very good at least at restoring the conference facilities of Downing Street.
Was it an old school one with acetates?
Yes.
Oh, lovely. Do you have one of those at school, John?
Yeah, and you like turn it round. Turn it round, you can write on it.
Write on it, yeah.
Lovely.
Happy days.
No wonder we lost in a landslide.
We're going to talk a bit later on about the Keir Starmer reshuffle. Clearly, this is the team that Keir Starmer wants to take into the next election. Is this the team that Rishi Sunak will take into the next election, Danny?
Close to it. So my conclusion that he, though, about his lack of a big reshuffle and losing that moment when Ben Wallace moved, is he's really concluded there aren't many people he can move, so he may as well stick with roughly this team to the election. I think so. And I think Keir Starmer's reshuffling in order to have the people around him he wants to govern. As well as to help him win the general election, I think Rishi Sunak has already got, you know, roughly what he wants, and there's no point doing it in order to freshen the team because we'll do that. He's achieved his one political objective, which was to promote Claire Coutinho so that she's a player in the Conservative Party from now on. And having done that, I'm not sure he's got any other particular objective.
John, what do you think?
Well, I think that was the clear thing from that reshuffle, that everyone spent several days talking about Grant Shapps and whether he had defence background, but it seemed that it was being done as a stepping stone. Clearly, he wants Claire Coutinho in a senior role in his cabinet, and you can't just push her from children's minister to, you know, one of the great offices of state. So it looked like it was a stepping stone, put her in that role. It's a brief that now that the different bits have been stripped out and hived off, it's a manageable brief. Yeah. It seemed like that was a way to boost her profile. But the idea, people talking about the possibility, oh, we might do another one after the King's speech. I mean, that's only in November. And remember that he has had to do repeated mini shuffles because of the people he chose in his team. Remember, there was obviously Gavin Williamson, Dominic Raab. Who else has gone? Nadeem Zahawi, that because of the constant stream of mini-sleaze scandals, he has had to slightly make different changes all over the place. And then there was that one when he moved all the letters around in the departments, which I can see that you speak to some people and you see, oh, there is a logic to having business and trade together. But when the clock is ticking down and you don't have that long before an election, you speak to people who worked in the old BEIS, the Business Energy and Industrial Strategy Department, who are now moved here and there. I just think that if you don't have much time to do stuff, moving the letters around in government departments.
None of that changes the fundamental problem that he has, which is 20 points behind in the polls. And Claire Coutinho is not going to single-handedly turn that around.
Yeah, but I don't think you could ever expect a reshuffle to do, that. So it's not why you do it. And I don't think because moving Nick Thomas Simmons into being a shadow cabinet office role from Department of International Trade is going to shift his Keir Starmer's poll rating. I noticed that Steve Howe, one of Corbyn's supporters, just said that he was bringing back the people who'd wasted Blair's 1990s, wasted the 1997 triumph, not pointing out that he was also bringing out the people who created the 1997 triumph in the first
And then
place.
Won twice more. Just finally then, Theresa May's portrait. Theresa May's been painted. What do you make of it, John?
I'm in two minds. So obviously she looks very miserable in it and very stern. And you wouldn't want it in your own wall. However, you can imagine pottering around Parliament, showing someone around Portcullis House, and then saying, oh, look at that Theresa May painting, and have a look at it and being like, it is a starting point.
If the person who did that painting is listening, I just want to say, I think you're a total genius. I couldn't do anything. I mean, just anybody who's listening
to as someone, I've been trying to paint Mariella Foss job, and it's really difficult.
You? How amazing is that?
We're doing it I think we're doing it tomorrow. We've been doing a painting competition after we both discovered we like to doodle, and mine is rubbish.
How amazing is that likeness? Yeah. I think it's extraordinary. The likeness is very good. I thought that painting was very, very good. I really did.
And I like this morning, on the morning round, Nick Gibb, the schools minister, who had loads of difficult questions about schools. He's someone who was in schools minister for 10 of the last 13 years. It's very tricky for him. Yeah. And he was asked what he thought of the painting. Got very awkward and just said, lovely.
John Stevens from The Mirror and Daniel Finkston, of course. From The Times, you can read Danny in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, we're going Blair to the future.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Redbox podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Well, I think he's made an excellent start as a leader, and look, the Labour Party's been through a pretty traumatic time.
That song, Things Can Only Get Better, that resonated.
And there's a difference between being a party of protest and a party of government.
Back in the day when I worked for the last Labour government, I worked for the Tony Blair Gordon Brown government as an advisor.
I think he also said, you know, that the party needed an antidote. The Blairites. Well, actually, what we need is an antidote to the Tories.
Yes, we're going Blair to the future, or at least Keir Starmer is, with his retro reshuffle confirming the Blairites are back. He's got a very new-looking shadow cabinet, but with not-so-new faces. The team that will take him into the next election definitely remembers what it was like to win elections before. Five of his new shadow ministers were all special advisers under Tony Blair. Well, Keir Starmer's been meeting with them this morning. This is what he told them.
And I reshuffled and formed this new team yesterday with all that in mind. And you are around this table because of four things. Your talent, your commitment, your hunger, really, really important, and because I wanted a team that wakes up every morning determined to rise to the challenges that our country faces and determined to prove our country for the better. So that is why you're around this table. And I'm really delighted and proud that you're all around this table.
Just to be clear, they are all around the table. In a moment, we're going to hear from Lord Mandelson to get his take on the reshuffle. But joining me in the studio now, Times columnist, Times Radio senior political correspondent, Patrick McGuire.
Hello, Matthew.
Got more job titles than Angela Rayner.
I know.
Good to have you here. And Chris Ward, former deputy chief of staff to Keir Starmer and now advisor at Hanbury Strategy. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Good to see you. Patrick, in your analysis reading it this morning, you've got someone, an MP said to you, even Tony Blair didn't have this many Blairites in the cabinet. We're not over-egging this, are we?
No. The important thing about that quote is I think it gets to the heart of what happened yesterday. So what they meant was Tony Blair's cabinets, there was an alternative power base in Gordon Brown, so they were always uneasy marriages of Blairites and Brownites, and there was a genuine sort of imbalance of power and a contest within the cabinet. Really now, you have one faction of the Parliamentary Labour Party that is in the ascendancy, that is dominant in Keir Starmer's shadow cabinets. And they are people who, by and large, you would describe as Blairites. So that might mean their ideological persuasion, they're on the modernising right of the party, or in many cases, they worked for New Labour, they worked for Tony Blair and, in some cases, Gordon Brown. And what does that mean politically for Keir Starmer? Well, I think the most immediate consequence and the most meaningful consequence is when Keir Starmer talks about reform over big spending in those key briefs, you know, health, education, work and pensions, the shadow treasury team, and now the cabinet office in Pat McFadden, he has people who mean what they say when they talk about reform of public services over big spending.
OK, but let's dive into this blockbuster reshuffle then, with a little help from Peter Dixon. Let's start with
Keir Starmer.
Chris, you worked with him on two reshuffles previously.
I did. I did the first two back when a reshuffle lasted 2 days. So this was like 3 hours. You got value for money when I was doing it.
So were you involved in the last Angela Rayner one?
I was, yeah.
This seems to have gone better. Is this a sign that relations between the two of them are better?
It went quicker, certainly. Yeah. Well, I think
because last time he tried to demote her and she ended up with five jobs.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the first thing you take from that is always reshuffle when you're strong and never reshuffle when you're tired at the end of a by-election that you've lost.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think he will be pretty relieved that yesterday went pretty well from his point of view, and I think he'll be pleased with the outcome. He'll be relieved because he hates doing reshuffles. He really, really hates it. And I think he'll be pleased because he's done the two things he wanted to do, right? Which was put his preparation for government team in place, which, as you said, is Pat McFadden, but it's also the campaign team has changed a bit more. The cabinet office has been beefed up. Sue Gray's coming in, obviously, to run the prep for government team. And the second bit is he wants to get what he would call his A team into each of the departments to do that. So I think he'll be relieved and pretty pleased.
Can you shed some light on the real Keir Starmer? Is this the real Keir Starmer? Actually, deep down, he's always been a Blairite, and this is where he wanted to be. And when he ran as a sort of Jeremy Corbyn in a smarter suit back 3 years ago, he was just pretending. Or was that the real Keir Starmer? And now he's pretending because he's realised that's how you win an election.
Yeah, so firstly, I wouldn't say he's a Blairite at all. Starmer's much more complex than that politically. He's much more ideologically fluid than that. The reason you can say he ran, sorry, to the left on with a sort of soft left plus parts of Corbyn plus, you know, got 60% of the parties, it's quite a lot. He ran there because he was able to embrace that. His politics doesn't fit neatly into one group. You got, I always say this, we talk about this, Starmer doesn't come from a faction of the party, and he always navigates his way around the party to where he's getting to. So I wouldn't say he's a Blairite, first and foremost. Yeah. I think what you're seeing now is a more confident Starmer and one who's much more able to put his shadow cabinet in place and pick his people. I think also, the other thing, and this is actually different to when we were doing it, I think there's less attempt in this shadow cabinet to have a unifying effort. It's much more him picking his own people to go in. I mean, Patrick, you spoke about that, but it's pretty much putting the people he wants in it. And I think there's a strategic decision that the party has taken to do that. And that's fine, right? You always do that as you get close to an election. Corbyn had a Corbyn cabinet. Miliband had a Miliband cabinet. And you get there the closer to the election.
And, and would you say that word reform is the key point?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I mean, Keir's, I think the first, when I first started working with Keir about 6 years ago, the first, I remember him getting invited by the, I think it was the Fabians, to write an article on anything he wanted to write on. And I had all these big ideas about what it might be quite good fun. And he said, I'm going to write it on public service reform. Public service reform is the most important thing. It's what I care about. It's what I did as DPP. He's got sidetracked by various things over the way, but he actually really cares
about
this.
That's where he thinks he wants to end up.
Now, the question would be whether he's reforming it. He's taken people from the right, just the right of the party to try and do that or not. He doesn't think like that, though. He would think, I've picked modernisers, I've picked sort of combination of experience and new people. I don't know, think of him like, I don't know, like an Alex Ferguson team or something, where he's got the core, the spine of the team is like an older, experienced team, and then he's got younger people attacking in different parts. So he's trying, I think in his head, he's picking modernisers, people who think in his way, and people who want to reform the party.
Okay, let's move on as we pick our way through this then. We've done Keir Starmer. Let's move on to
Angela Rayner.
How significant is this move, Patrick? Angela Rayner moving to shadow Michael Gove at Levelling Up. I mean, parallels being drawn with John Prescott, this sort of yin and yang, Tony Blair, the smoothie, John Prescott, the straight-talking northerner, in charge of a big department. You know, there's clearly comparisons there between Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner.
Yeah, and I think the point about a big domestic department is one of the important ones, right? Because John Prescott had a huge sprawling department for much of his time as Deputy Prime Minister. And so, look, it's a way of giving them a departmental power base. Prescott himself said that was the one of the most important lessons he learned, is that you need, as Deputy Prime Minister, a big power base. Look, Angela Rayner has got what she wanted, i.e. a big domestic brief she can get her teeth into. Keir Starmer has a preparing for government team and a campaign team he can properly, truly trust. And also, an important thing to note from yesterday is Angela Rayner got another new title, which was Shadow Deputy Prime Minister, which confirms for the first time she will be Deputy Prime Minister. You know, Gordon Brown had a deputy leader in Harriet Harman who he never made Deputy Prime Minister.
That's interesting. Well, let's move on, because we need to talk about the person whose job that Angela Rayner's taken.
Lisa Nandy!
Now, when you and I spoke about this yesterday, Patrick, we were discussing how a lot of the people that Keir Starmer promoted yesterday were not people that supported him for the Labour leadership. In fact, it's striking that Lisa Nandy, you know, ran against him last time in the leadership. Is that significant?
That she ran against him for the leadership?
Well, I suppose two things. She ran against, but also he's now sort of, a lot of the people he's promoting as the great future of the party didn't even want him to be leader.
Well, it's interesting, because that speaks to something Chris was saying, right, in that it's the politician Keir Starmer has become confident and being able to speak the same language that the people who backed Jess Phillips, who was the sort of Blairite standard bearer in 2020 rather. Those people seeing Keir, a politician who they can trust with a reforming Blairite agenda, who's not making those compromises. That wasn't necessarily obvious from the unifying campaign that was run in 2020. And look, the Lisa Nandy question yesterday was a fascinating one. I think the whole episode really underlined the almost total authority Keir Starmer has over the PLP at the moment. Because, and Chris, having been there, you'll know how it could have unfolded yesterday. Keir Starmer could have offered Lisa Nandy a demotion and she could have said, absolutely not, and walked out and made a huge fuss. That didn't happen.
Sorry, go on, Chris.
No, I was going to say, look, I mean, I worked really closely with Lisa. I think she's great. I think she's a really good communicator. I'm really pleased she's still in the shadow cabinet. I think it's a bit of a shame that she isn't in a more empowered position, if I'm being honest. I think she's a strong communicator, and I think her and her relationship, it has basically deteriorated over the last couple of years with Keir in the Leeds office. I think that's a bit of a shame, personally.
Just finally, we need to talk about
Thangam Debonair!
Just because it's the last one we've got. What to make of the Thangam Debonair appointment, Patrick?
I think, you know, Thangam Debonair, good media performer, as we well know here on Times Radio, is been promoted. I'd say one thing, actually, we're talking about Lisa Nandy, Northern Woman MP in Greater Manchester. Lucy Powell, who was very, very keen to take on the new science brief that's been given to Peter Kyle, another Greater Manchester Woman MP, given a job she didn't really want in shadow leader of the House of Commons. That was something that was a big topic of conversation among Labour people on the terrace last night. You do wonder, now it seems like a moot point, or even facile to say, let's look at the politics 2 or 3 years down the line. But there was one veteran Labour MP yesterday saying, in, every leader's downfall, the seeds were sown at the point of maximum strength. And you do wonder, you look down the line, there are lots of Northern MPs Keir Starmer might have alienated. When the going gets tough, do you see a wing of the party coalescing around Andy Burnham?
And that I suppose, actually, is the point, is that by picking his side, picking a side in the grand spectrum of the Labour Party and alienating some of them, it's fine now, but at some point, you know, John McDonald becomes your Jacob Rees-Mogg or whatever it might be. Before we let you go...
On Thangham, very, very quickly, people always say that you have square pegs around holes. Thangham was like a professional musician, right? Yeah. She plays cello, she's gone into culture, she'd be great
in it. We've had her on before playing the cello.
It's perfect, you know...
Chris, a bit earlier on, Danny Finkelstein said we should open a museum of political fiasco to put like Liz Truss's lectern in it. What would you put in it?
Are you gonna float the reshuffle we did? The 2-day reshuffle? Is that what you're gonna say?
How would you capture that in a? What would be the object that you would put in the museum?
Your Deliveroo receipts or something
I don't know. Me and several others escaping to McDonald's at some point in the afternoon. Good question. I don't know. That's the first thing that springs to my mind. The Hartlepool by election.
A McDonald's box.
Sort
of in a glass case.
I've still got this picture of McSweeney coming back with a massive amount of McDonald's in the middle of it, with it all going around us, not very well.
Yeah. Morgan McSweeney's Happy Meal toys.
There you go.
Chris, really good to see you. Chris,
good to see you. Thank you.
Forward Chief, Deputy Chief of Staff to Keir Starmer, now at Hanbury Strategy.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Well, good morning to you, Matt Chorley, on Times Radio, taking a look at Keir Starmer's reshuffle. Well, it's still ongoing. He hasn't finished yet. He's going to do the junior ranks. He's been chairing his new look shadow cabinet this morning, thanking them all for being back around the table, saying they're there, but thanks to their talent, commitment, hunger, and wanting to wake up every morning and fight to get into government. But lots of the analysis, including by Patrick Maguire, who's still with me in the studio, has focused on the shift to the right, the move to promote people who worked for New Labour, who've championed New Labour, who describe themselves as Blairites. Well, who better to speak to when discussing champions of New Labour than the man who created it himself, Peter Manderson. Lord Manderson, good morning.
Why haven't I received a phone call then, if we're now back to the 1990s? I seem to be the one who's been left out.
69-year-old veterans of New Labour, Peter. Hillary Benn, you must be next.
Look, I mean, it's perfectly clear that with Hillary Benn's return, and he'll be very good in Northern Ireland as well, I mean, there's a chance for the oldest.
Are you waiting by the phone, Peter?
Things are looking up.
What is your assessment of it? Is it actually Keir Starmer moving quite a long way from the position he ran on originally back in 2020? Is that the right analysis? And is it the right thing to do?
Well, I think two things are happening. One is that he's reconsidering, thinking through afresh the sort of policies, the programme that he wants to set out to fight on at the next election and then implement should he be elected in government. That's one thing, and that accounts for his moving quite a long way from that 10-point manifesto on which he fought the leadership election in 2019-20. We can come back to that if you want, but it's now lost in the mists of... The second thing he's doing is finding the right people, both to raise Labour's campaign game between now and the election, and it's probably going to be at least a year, but also the people who are going to help him prepare those plans for government. The five missions that he's decided he wants to be the priorities for a Starmer-led Labour government, well, they need to do more drilling down, more strength and depth, and that, again, is what's going to happen, you're going to see happening over the next year, and he's got better people, in my view, in place to help him do that.
I mean, Keir Starmer has been very keen to stress the differences between now and 97. In fact, was it Tony Blair's, I can't remember what it was called, centrist dad fest thing? What was it called? The Future of Britain?
Future Britain Conference.
They were having in conversation on stage, and Keir Starmer was talking about how the political landscape now compares to 97. Let's just take a listen.
We've only won from opposition three times. And obviously, 97 was the last time. And the mood then was one of growing optimism. That song, Things Can Only Get Better, that resonated because it felt that was the mood of the country at the time. The economy was growing, and you know, what Labour was able to come in and absolutely sort of turbocharge that sense that we're going to go into a new century, it's a new way of doing politics, modernising, things can only get better. That's not the position now, by a long shot.
Some people listened to that, Peter, and thought it's not very hopey change, is it? We can't promise that things are going to get better. Does Keir Starmer need to try and capture a bit of that?
No, I'm not sure that Keir's absolutely right about this in 97. I mean, he's right and wrong, because I think what characterised the election in 1997 was that we had just come out of a sort of ghastly decade of failure for the country, during which, you know, the Conservatives were falling out with each other and basically falling apart over Europe. But that's essentially how you could characterise Thatcher's election in 1979. She came in after a decade of quite shameful failure in the running of the country, the government of the country, first under Heath, and then not frankly very successfully under Wilson. And she said, right, great sea change got to take place. The last decade's got to be, has been a terrible failure. We've now got to close this chapter. She pulled the rug from underneath the sort of the consensus, the post-war sort of corporatist consensus system of government and approach, and said, no, it's time for something completely different. And that, of course, is exactly what Attlee did in 1945 as well. Attlee said, you know, look at the 1930s, a terrible decade of failure, the public's interests completely let down. We've got to, it's been an era of decline. We've got to turn the page and start afresh in this post-war world. And I think actually what Keir Starmer is able to point to is something very, very similar. Similar to Attlee, similar to Thatcher, similar to Blair. We've had a decade of failure. We've got to close this chapter, turn the page, and start a new chapter in our national story. I think that's really what the next election is going to be about.
Well, Peter, Keir has a shadow cabinet around him now who are prepared to speak about significant reform to public services and mean it and believe it when they say it in those key briefs like health and welfare, you know, ditto the Treasury team, all the delivery briefs, education, are all people who believe what they say, believe that very Blairite mantra of reform. But how can, you know, as the Times leader makes this point this morning, how can they do that without significant capital investment in a, you know, crumbling public realm? And where's the money going to come from?
Well, it's a perfectly good question, but it's one that will be much easier to answer in a year's time when we see what the state of the economy is. I mean, what the fiscal headroom that's available to us will be in a year's time depends on what's happened to the economy in the meantime and what the prospects for renewed economic growth will be. What our borrowing capacity will be will depend on borrowing costs at the time and what's happened to interest rates during the previous year, and also the confidence of the markets, how much they're prepared to lend. Now, I can't tell you, Patrick, you know, sitting here in the beginning of September in 2023, what in over a year's time the state of the economy, the state of the markets will be, the state of Treasury revenues will be, what the fiscal headroom will be. I can't tell you all these things.
So, Peter, is it a mistake then that we've seen that across the board, Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer keep ruling out things, ruling out increasing income tax, ruling out, you know, they oppose the increase in national insurance to help social care. That should they stop making promises like that? In fact, I think we've got a clip. This is Paul Johnson, director of the Institute of Fiscal Studies, who was on the show yesterday.
If you commit to increasing, as they have done, by hundreds and hundreds of thousands, the number of people working in the NHS, which we need for the NHS to be working properly in 10, 15 years, you need to say that that's going to cost money. And the only way I can see that that money's going to come from is by higher taxes, because it's not going to come from cutting the schools budget or cutting the defence budget or cutting the justice budget. There just isn't the money there.
Is Paul Johnson right, Peter? And as a result, is Keir Starmer wrong to rule out increasing income tax?
I don't think he's wrong, because we are now at the highest level of tax in this country of any time since the Second World War. and with a cost of living crisis felt so severely by people, you know, it's really not fair, it's not right, it's certainly not election winning to go into an election and saying, well, you know, we've got sky high taxes and we're going to load more onto them. No, I don't think you can do that. But there may well be, and Paul Johnson would be the first to acknowledge this, that the fiscal state of the country will depend, as I say, on the state of the economy, the prospects for growth, and therefore treasury revenues, which we can appraise in a year's time.
Peter, before I let you go, if Keir Starmer did pick up the phone, Gordon Brown style, and say, come on, join the gang again, have a job, you know, you're in the House of Lords already, so you don't need to go through that rigmarole again, would you do it?
Well, it's a lovely idea, but I don't think it's going to happen. And anyway, there's quite a lot I can do with them and for them, from the confines of my present office. You know, I'm going to give them all the help they want and all the help they need to get elected and to prepare their plans for government. I don't have to be, you know, on the inside track in order to do that. It's what I do to a certain extent already. I don't do as much with or for Keir Starmer, obviously, as I did for Tony Blair or Gordon Brown or indeed Neil Kinnock before them. But, you know, where I can make a contribution, I always will, because I want Labour to be elected, because I think that's what we need, the sort of cathartic experience in this country of a change of government. And I believe in what the Labour Party now is saying it will do for the country if it's elected, in a way that I couldn't possibly have said with equal confidence under Jeremy Corbyn. 2019.
I think if I'd have asked you if Jeremy Corbyn asked you in to help him out, I'm pretty sure I know what the answer would have been. Finally, Peter, I don't know if you heard earlier on, Danny Finkelstein was talking about how he ought to have a museum of political fiasco, put Liz Truss's lectern in there. Chris said he'd put Happy McDonald's, Happy Meals, and one of their disastrous reshuffles. What would you put in a museum of political fiasco?
I don't know. I've got one or two political fiascos of my own I could sort of put in the museum.
What have you got in mind?
I'm not sure I really want to go revisit them. And
a pot of guacamole, Peter.
Indeed. Thank you.
Peter Madison, always lovely to speak to you. Thanks so much for joining us today. That's Peter Madison there. Before that, we heard from Chris Ward, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Keir Starmer, and Patrick McGuire, Times columnist, Times writer, broadcaster, senior political correspondent for Times Radio.
Gentleman of leisure.
Shadow Secretary of State for the Future of Work. It's only a matter of time.
That's next.
Good to see you.
I will take a peerage if I'm offered.
Of course you would. I bet you already know what the name's going to be. Lord McGuire
Of Southport.
And that's all we've got time for on today's episode. Don't miss tomorrow when we've got the first PMQs unpacked in ages. So hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to
go.acast.com/closer to get started.